Governor, I ask, did you have anything to do with these lane closures in September outside the GW Bridge? 80 days after the lanes reopened, Christie is being asked about the lane closures for the first time. His answer is instantly infamous. I worked the cones, actually, Matt. Unbeknownst to everybody, I was actually the guy out there. I was in overalls and a hat, but I was actually the guy working the cones out there. You really are not serious with that question.
So for purposes of introduction, Chris Christie, governor of New Jersey, and Matt Katz, WNYC Peabody Award-winning reporter and author of American Governor, Chris Christie's Bridge to Redemption. Matt Katz, thanks for joining us once again on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave.
And of course, that's a recitation from your brand new book on Chris Christie. It's a wonderful book, and it's a retrospective not just of his career as governor, but it starts all the way back at his and his family's roots coming to New Jersey.
That's right. He his roots are all in Newark, New Jersey. His family came over in the 1850s and 1860s. He often talks about how he's half Sicilian and half Irish. In fact, much of his roots are German and Scottish. He does have some Italian roots, obviously, but the Christie name is Scottish. And they all came to this country via Newark, and they were laborers. I mean, he's got a very traditional immigrant experience where for generations they were hardworking type people. There was alcoholism in the family. There was early divorce. It was a rough go of it for them for several generations. And Christie is really the first in his family to break through to this upper class tier economically and socially.
An uncle apparently once said that Christie wanted to be a politician when he was a baby.
Not only that, there's parents of his fellow classmates in elementary school who remember him talking about wanting to be president. His grandmother thought that he was going to be a politician. There's talk of him reading law books at a young age. He ran for student body president and won student body president every year of middle school and high school, and was student body president in college. I mean, this is somebody who has had ambitions to lead from a very, very early age.
And so graduated school, ultimately going into law. How did it morph from law to politics?
He became a partner at his firm. He started doing a little lobbying work. And then in his early 30s, he decided to run for office in Morris County, a county freeholder. And the reason why he won is he ran on an ethics platform. And he alleged that the incumbent Morris County freeholders were under investigation by the county prosecutor. That, of course, was not true. So although he did win the election based on that critique of his opponents, he was sued for defamation because he had lied about them being under investigation.
Now, perhaps not all our listeners know what a freeholder is, and you describe New Jersey's messy democracy, some 8,900 elected positions, 565 municipalities, almost as many school districts.
That's right. There's all kinds of elected politicians in the state, and that's part of the reason why we think it is traditionally so corrupt. There's just so many people running government that have a chance at getting their hand in the kitty, that has just been a traditionally corrupt state. And Christie was the guy who was supposed to clean that up. He was U.S. attorney, and he made his name as U.S. attorney of New Jersey by prosecuting corrupt politicians.
Some 130 of them.
That's correct. This was how he got media attention when he was U.S. attorney, because New Jersey was so hungry for somebody to clean up the state. He did fascinating things to some of these politicians. He put the executive of Essex County in leg shackles for 2.5 hours after arresting him, which was seen as quite unusual punishment for alleged white-collar crime. But it was a way of Christie sending a message. It was a way of Christie showing the sort of flair he has for what he does in public life. And it's fascinating, of course, because corruption was what he made his name on. And then it's also, as we learned toward the end of the book, it's what almost led to the end of his political career.
He resigned as U.S. attorney to run for governor.
He resigned as U.S. attorney to run for governor, and he beat John Corzine, incumbent Democrat, in a very blue state. And he did that in part by taking very moderate positions, moderate Republican positions.
So, some of which he's since renounced, some of the social positions regarding abortion or gun control.
He has renounced most positions of import to conservatives. And that would be gun control. He first ran for office in the 90s on a platform to get rid of assault weapons in New Jersey. He used to be pro-choice. He had said in 1994 that he donated to Planned Parenthood. He used to say that New Jersey's gun laws, even when he was running for governor, and then in his first term as governor, he said he supported New Jersey's tough gun laws. Now, when he's campaigning, he says that New Jersey's gun laws are a problem, and he is trying to do everything he can to roll them back.
So from U.S. attorney, where he was renowned for going after corruption, you describe the messy New Jersey system, and you don't have to be in office. The political leaders include Steve Adubato, Joe DiVincenzo, and perhaps best known to listeners in our South Jersey region, George Norcross.
George Norcross is probably the most powerful unelected person in the state of New Jersey. When Christie was U.S. attorney, actually investigated Norcross for alleged corruption. He dropped the case, didn't find anything, and of course Norcross has never been charged with anything. But once Christie was elected governor, he ended up cozying up to Norcross. They became quite close, went to Phillies games together, Eagles games together, and they made a lot of deals based on a common interest in Camden. And that meant education reform. It meant that Christie signed a bill that Norcross proposed to create a new kind of school, a new kind of publicly financed, privately run school.
And they weren't calling it a charter, but
they weren't. It's called a Renaissance school, and now the Norcross has his name on that school in Camden. And then in exchange, you know, Christie got a lot of policies through a Democratic legislature because he was able to get the Democrats who were under Norcross's thumb. And then I report in the book that they also had another deal that they called the 195 deal, and that meant that Christie would not campaign for Republicans south of 195 in the Norcross realm in the 2013 legislative elections. And in exchange, Norcross Democrats really didn't do much campaigning at all for Christie's gubernatorial opponent at
the
time, Barbara Buono.
This was the quid pro quo.
That's right. And their camps have denied it, but to some extent. But I also know from sources that this was the deal, and that was called the 195 deal.
As we see, the 76ers practice facility and construction around Cooper Hospital also having both Christie and Norcross's thumbprints on it.
Absolutely. All the economic development going on there, which there's two ways of looking at that. Some people are thrilled by it. They think only because these men decided to cross party lines and work together can all this stuff be happening in Camden. But others view it more cynically because these places, by and large, do not pay property taxes. They by and large, do not employ Camden residents. So they're controversial economic development projects, but without question, a lot has happened in Camden, including the takeover of the city force by county government because Norcross and Christie worked together. And at a statewide level, without Norcross, Christie would have never been nearly the successful governor he was in the first term, getting various policies through.
That he was a successful governor, when did it emerge even further to become America's governor?
It started happening once his bully pulpit started catching fire on YouTube. So when he started yelling at teachers at town hall meetings, when he started calling reporters thin-skinned, this really lit a fire in the conservative base around the country.
You call him America's first YouTube political phenomenon.
Without question. I mean, he was the first one to really have a YouTube channel that was viewed by people all over the country. What his people would do in the governor's office is they would email it out to reporters around the country, and then it would find its way onto conservative talk radio shows. It would find its way onto, you know, conservative blogs in Iowa and New Hampshire. And this is very early on in his first term, where using his natural speaking abilities in front of a microphone, coupled with his media teams, his government-funded, taxpayer-funded media teams' propensity to put stuff on YouTube and sophistication, knowing that they could pass pass things around virally. And then couple that with a sort of a Tea Party wave that was going on at the time in 2010, 2011. He was really able to capture the imaginations of conservatives around the country, and that's why there was such a clarion call for him to run for president in 2011.
Which he ultimately rejected.
He ultimately rejected. He had a very, very crowded news conference at the state capitol to say that he was not going to run, but it was after a very long flirtation, and he made a speech in 2011 right before he decided not to run at the Reagan Library, where people were begging him, getting up, please, Governor, we need you, we need you, you must help us and save our country. And he decided not to run. Instead, he endorsed Mitt Romney and campaigned pretty hard for him until
it was time to make that big speech in which he apparently cited his name far more often than alluding
yes.
to Romney.
Yes, he got the he didn't get the nod for VP, although he was on the short list. So his consolation prize was that he made the big speech at the convention. But then he talked about himself almost the entire time. He also put a biographical video of himself that he insisted, contrary to what Romney's team really wanted, he insisted it air in advance of his speech. And it really sounded like something to boost up his own credentials rather than to help out Mitt.
I'm moving ahead, but I'm wondering if the student exceeded the master, the student being Donald Trump, in terms of self-aggrandizement and self-advertisement.
Yeah, you do think that Trump is sort of a Christier Christie. If Christie made his name on his political personality, on telling it like it is, on saying things that you just weren't accustomed to hearing from politicians normally, then Trump has really just taken that to the next level. And maybe that's what has hurt Christie recently more than anything, is that there's another loudmouth New York area guy who seems to just tell it like it is more than
the lip.
Shoot from the lip, exactly right. And I also wonder if Trump would have gotten in this thing if Christie hadn't been so damaged by Bridgegate. Maybe he wouldn't have.
What's this Bridgegate thing again?
Yeah. this happened right at the end of Christie's first term. In fact, it was 5 days before his inauguration to his second term, where the famous email, "Time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee," was revealed, that was sent by a top aide to shut down the busiest bridge in the world.
A few months earlier, around Labor Day.
Exactly right. For 5 days, they shut down these lanes, causing traffic in the town of Fort Lee.
And wasn't it ultimately New York Governor Cuomo who reversed that decision?
It was Cuomo's appointee. That's exactly right. And reversed the decision, reopened the lanes. And Christie, of course, said he knew absolutely nothing about it. But it resulted in months and months of intense media scrutiny, of negative media attention. And Christie, in December of 2013, was far and away leading Republican polls for the 2016 election. And then that really all started to change the following month when this smoking gun email was revealed.
And I've spoken to you often on this program about Christie. Is it your opinion that it acted as enough of a lag on his momentum to forever damage him in terms of his chances for this election?
It was hard to reconcile the guy who we knew as the telling it like it is. I mean, this is what he told us. I'm going to tell it to you straight. With this scandal that had so many unanswered questions that just didn't fully make sense. We couldn't understand why all these top officials were involved in this conspiracy and he wouldn't have known about it, or he wouldn't have been able to, quash it after it happened, or he wouldn't have been able to fire the right people before the smoking gun was revealed. So it really just damaged this perception we had of him, and I really think it hurt him for the election he's now struggling in to this point.
Again, that he paradoxically traded on this notion of openness and transparency, and yet you say his governorship has been shrouded in secrecy in terms of penetrating how it works.
He has released one email that he has sent from his entire governorship, and that email was only released due to a subpoena. And that's just indicative of the various ways in which the administration has hidden what has normally been public information. At WNYC, we've sued him for documents, and we've won. Many news organizations have had to sue for documents. The state taxpayers have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars defending these lawsuits related to public records. This has not been a transparent government by any way you look at it.
In spite of your efforts for years now following Christie, and the book is written from press row, describe, if you can, your special relationship, as it were, with the governor. You had a couple of opportunities to sit down with him privately in advance of this book and over the entire tenure, both you and your cohort.
Yeah, you know, he's got this, his humor is a smack-talking humor. And that's been, during the first term, pre-Bridgegate, that was our relationship with him. You know, at press conferences, he would make fun of us.
The scion of sarcasm.
Yes, for sure. See, when he announced that he wasn't running for president, this crowded press conference, a TV reporter said, Governor, do you have any regrets about not running for president? And I was sitting in the back of the room. I had just been on ABC, on TV, to talk about Christie and his possible run for the presidency. And the governor said, do I have any regrets about not running? Yeah, I have regrets. Matt Katz is not going to be able to get on TV anymore. Who's going to put Matt Katz on TV? Nobody's going to put a Matt Katz on TV now. And that's kind of the way he always was. Things, though, took a little bit of a darker turn after Bridgegate. Our relationship in general between the press and Christie got a lot more tense. And it was less funny and more aggressive. And I do have an exchange in the book in which we're sitting down for an interview for the book and we're talking about Bridgegate. And he, I kept asking questions that he didn't want to answer, and he got pretty upset with me at one point. Another was this one time when I had written something that the governor did not particularly like, and you know, sometimes when you write something he doesn't like, you don't necessarily know that he doesn't like it. You just find yourself in the penalty box. This is what Team Christie calls it. And when you're in the penalty box, you text, let's say, a source, a close aide to Christie, and you get a response back like, I can't talk to you right now. I'm not allowed to talk to you right now. That's how you know you're in the penalty box. Other times, it is much more clear that you're in the penalty box. So I was at a diner once. Christie was campaigning for a congressional candidate, and I was covering the campaign event. And Christie walked up to me and very subtly but very sternly said, meet me outside. So I went and met him outside. It was raining, and he told his body guy, Dan, he said, Dan, put him in the car. And Dan waited outside in the rain, and I got in the back seat of the SUV. There was a state trooper sitting in the driver's seat. The car was idling. Christie got in the front of the SUV in the passenger seat, turned around, pointed a finger at me, and scolded me like a father would to a child who is misbehaving in the back of the car during a family road trip. I struggled with whether to go into details of what he said to me, and decided that the nature of our relationship is that conversation was likely off the record. But suffice to say that he got the message across, and he did another thing.
He
was not subtle in delivering the message. And when I got out of the SUV, and this is the other effect it had, not only was Dan, the body guy, standing there in the rain waiting for me to get done getting yelled at, but the other reporters were there as well, the rest of the press corps, and they were very, curious as to what happened. And I think he was sending a message that he was almost making an example out of me. It was a revealing interaction, to say the least.
Though referring to your epilogue, I'm reminded of the Dos Equis commercial, the most interesting person in the world. You refer to him as the most interesting American politician to cover.
He is full of contradictions. He is he could call somebody an idiot, and yet behind closed doors in the room, he'll charm your pants off. He is incredibly entertaining to watch at a town hall meeting. He can be captivating. He'll make people laugh and cry, literally cry, whether he's talking about his mother on her deathbed or what he was doing on September 11th. 2001, it'll make him laugh and cry in the same sentence. It's really remarkable. He's got incredible talent at talking, and he is, and his political style is full of contradictions that I just find him incredibly fascinating. And I do think that because he's, you know, kind of so complex, that he really is the most fascinating politician in the country.
Chris Christie is 53 years young. He's not going away, whether he prevails in this next race or not. Do you have any sense of his next appetite?
I think it's plausible, but not likely, if he were to not win the nomination, that he could be a VP or attorney general in a Republican administration. I think those are possibilities. He cannot run for governor again. He's term limited out. So the other possibility, the most obvious non-political possibility for him, would be a TV show on MSNBC or Fox. I think the dark horse job for him down the line, it would be a sports league commissioner. I could see him as an NFL commissioner or Major League Baseball commissioner.
Maybe he'll get into that line of business with Ed Rendell.
That's right.
Another former governor.
And similar politicians in some ways, you know, big guys, tell like it is, you know, kind of a frank, controversial way of talking.
Listeners in our region, I'm sure, will love this book as I did. It's chock full of anecdotes and revelations. Who is the larger intended audience?
If Christie is relevant in this race going forward, if he is among the four or five people that make it out of New Hampshire and Iowa, then anybody who is voting in a Republican primary and eventually voting in the general election should want to read the book, I think. I mean, it's journalism, but it gives, you know, all various sides of him, from some of the darker stuff to some of his more positive moments, like in those first days after Superstorm Sandy, when he really displayed a kind of leadership that was very important for a state that was seriously shooken up by the worst natural disaster in its history.
Even though he had to subsequently walk back his hug with President Obama.
He has had to walk that back, for sure.
I'm worried about you, Matt Katz. Are you going to go into some kind of postpartum when the governor's tenure is done?
I'm just hoping that when I wake up in the middle of the night, he's not in my head, as he always is. I hope I stop having dreams about him after this is all over. I have been covering him for 5 years now. It's been a full time job and then some. So wherever he goes, I'll be you know, ready to move on, I guess, once this is over.
Best of everything with this great book. Thanks for joining us again on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave. I appreciate the time.
WNYC Peabody Award-winning reporter Matt Katz, author of the new book entitled American Governor, Chris Christie's Bridge to Redemption.